A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's the thing about red light for sleep. The person asking Daniel's question already uses one every night, and it works. That's settled. What's not settled is what happens when they go to buy a better one, and every listing they open says the same thing. 670 nanometers. Peak wavelength. As if that number is the reason the thing works. Daniel's got a whole buyer's confusion wrapped up in that number. Either it matters or it doesn't. If it matters, what's it actually doing for sleep? If it doesn't, why did the serious brands all print it? And is seeing it a reason to trust a product, avoid it, or neither? And underneath that, the real question, how do you tell a good red light from a bad one when every spec sheet looks the same? The answer that organizes the whole thing is that 670 is a badge, not a mechanism. And a badge can still be useful information. That's the episode.
And the badge has a real history. It didn't come from a sleep lab, which is the first thing to get straight. 670 nanometers is a photobiomodulation wavelength. It's the number Glenn Jeffries' group at UCL made famous.
The eye study?
The eye study, 2020. Older adults, declining color vision, and they had them sit in front of a deep red light for a few minutes a day. The wavelength was 670, and the results were interesting. Color contrast sensitivity improved, in some cases by around 20%. The mechanism they proposed was mitochondrial. Cytochrome C oxidase, which is an enzyme in the electron transport chain, absorbs long-wave red light. The idea is that it improves mitochondrial function in retinal cells, which decline with age because the retina is enormously metabolically active.
So it's not a made-up number. It's a real research wavelength with a real proposed mechanism.
Right. And I want to be careful here, because it's easy to sneer at photobiomodulation, and I don't think that's warranted. It's an active research area. The retinal work is the strongest part of it, and Jeffrey's group has published follow-ups. The mechanism is plausible. Cytochrome C oxidase does absorb in that range. Whether the effect sizes translate to clinical recommendations is a different question, but this isn't crystals and magnets, it's biology.
And that's exactly why the number acquired prestige. It borrowed credibility from a real scientific literature. A brand that prints 670 isn't inventing a wavelength. They're attaching themselves to a body of work that sounds serious because it's serious.
But here's the problem. That pedigree is for a different question than the one you're asking when you buy a sleep light. The photobiomodulation story is about mitochondrial function in retinal cells. The sleep story is about melatonin. And those are two different mechanisms that both happen to involve red light. Conflating them is the root of the confusion.
So walk me through the sleep side. Why is 670 not doing the work there?
Because the photopigment that drives the circadian system is melanopsin, and melanopsin peaks around 480 nanometers. That's blue. The intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells that tell your brain it's daytime are tuned to short wavelengths. So what protects melatonin at night is the absence of short wavelengths, plus keeping the intensity low. Once you're out at the long end of the spectrum, the precise figure barely matters. 620, 670, 700. They're all doing the same job for sleep, which is simply not being blue.
So the number is nearly irrelevant as a mechanism, but not as a signal.
And that's the turn. A brand that prints a peak wavelength is a brand that knows what emitter it bought. Somebody measured that. Somebody bought binned LEDs from a real supplier. Somebody could produce a spectral chart if you asked. That's a different operation from the white label reseller who bought whatever red bulbs were available and printed the word red on the box.
Or worse, copied 670 from a competitor without knowing what it means.
Yes, and that's the thing. The number is a decent proxy for manufacturing seriousness while being nearly irrelevant as a mechanism. It's a correlated signal, not a causal ingredient.
That distinction is the transferable lesson. It applies everywhere. A spec sheet mixes genuine mechanisms with prestige markers, and the skill is telling which is which. Sometimes a badge is just a badge. But sometimes a badge is a signal that someone cared enough to measure.
So then the actual question Daniel's caller has. If 670 isn't the spec to shop on, what is?
Previous episode settled. That intensity matters more than color, so we take that as given. The next axis is LED and product quality. Let's go through the spec sheet you should actually be reading.
First thing, is there a spectral power distribution chart published at all?
The squiggly line graph.
The squiggly line graph. And most listings don't have one. They have a photo of a red bulb and the words 670 nanometers. But a real manufacturer publishes the chart. And once you have it, you look at two things. Peak wavelength, which is where the curve tops out, and full width at half maximum. That's how wide the peak is at half its height. A narrow peak means the emitter is actually doing what it claims. A broad hump means you're getting a lot of light you didn't ask for.
So a tight peak at 670 with a narrow full width at half maximum is a very different product from a broad hump that spills down toward the shorter wavelengths.
And that spill matters. If your red light has a broad spectral output that reaches toward amber and orange, you're getting closer to the wavelengths that start to matter for melanopsin. Not dramatically, but the point of a spectral chart is you can see what you're actually getting.
Let me push on that, because I think there's a subtlety here. How broad is broad? If someone's looking at a chart and the peak is at 670, but there's a shoulder that extends down to 600, is that actually a problem in practice? Or is this one of those things where the difference is measurable but not meaningful?
That's a fair question, and I think the honest answer is that it's a gradient, not a cliff. The melanopsin sensitivity curve drops off steeply as you move away from 480, but it doesn't hit zero at 550. There's still a tail. So a broad emitter that spills toward 600 is delivering slightly more circadian stimulus than a narrow one that stays tight at 670. Whether that slight difference matters for sleep depends on how sensitive you are, how bright the light is, and how close it's to your face. For most people, at the dim levels you'd actually use in a bedroom, the difference is probably small, but the spectral chart tells you whether the manufacturer even thought about this. A narrow peak is a sign of intentional design. A broad hump is a sign of, we bought whatever was cheap.
So it's less about the exact width, and more about what the width reveals.
It's the same badge logic. The chart itself is the signal. The details matter, but the fact that someone published them matmatters more.
What about melanopic EDI? You mentioned that earlier.
That's the metric that actually answers the sleep question. Melanopic equivalent daylight illuminance. It weights light by how strongly it stimulates the melanopsin pathway. So instead of asking what color the light looks, you're asking how much circadian disruption it's actually delivering. A true red light has a melanopic EDI near zero. A warm white bulb at the same visual brightness has a much higher one.
And almost nothing consumer grade quotes it.
Almost nothing. Which is itself informative. If a brand quotes melanopic EDI, or even knows what it's when you email them, that's a strong signal. It means they've thought about the actual mechanism, not just the marketing.
So that's two things. Spectral chart, melanopic EDI. What's the third?
The dimming floor. This is the most under-discussed spec for a bedside light, and I think it matters more than anything else on the list.
Because you're using this in a dark bedroom, not trying to light a warehouse.
Right. The maximum brightness is almost irrelevant. What matters is how low it goes. Does it drop to a faint glow, or does it bottom out at something that still feels like a nightlight on steroids? And does it step at the bottom of the range, or fade smoothly? A light that clicks from off to 20% is useless for the middle of the night.
The usable minimum. That's the spec.
And it's the one nobody prints. You have to dig through reviews or test it yourself. But it's where the product either works for this application or doesn't.
I want to dwell on this for a second because I think the dimming floor is where the rubber meets the road for actual human use. You've got someone who wakes up at 3 a.m. They need to get to the bathroom or check on a kid. Their eyes are fully dark adapted. If the light clicks on at even 10%, it's blinding. It's like someone shining a torch in your face. So the question isn't just, does it dim low, but does it dim low enough that a dark adapted eye can tolerate it?
And that's a much lower level than most people realize. True dark adaptation is incredibly sensitive. A single candle in a dark room is a lot of light when your eyes have adjusted. So the dimming floor needs to go down to what feels like almost nothing, a faint ember. And most consumer lights don't get anywhere near that. They bottom out at a level that's fine for watching TV, but useless for the middle of the night.
Which is why the smoothness of the dimming curve matters too. If it goes from off to a faint glow in one click, that's still a shock. You want it to fade up gradually so your eye has time to adjust.
And that's a driver sophistication question. Cheap drivers step, good drivers fade. The difference is in the electronics, not the emitter.
What about flicker? You've talked before about drivers.
Driver quality. This is where cheap lights fall apart exactly where you want to use them. Pulse width modulation. The driver dims the LED by switching it on and off very fast. At high brightness, the switching is fast enough you never notice. At deep, dim levels, cheap drivers slow down or get sloppy, and you get flicker, sometimes visible, sometimes not. Even invisible flicker can cause eye strain and headaches in some people.
And there's a practical test.
The phone camera test. Point your phone camera at the light, dim it to the bottom of its range, and look at the screen. If you see bands rolling or the light strobing on the screen, the driver is struggling. It's not a perfect test, but it catches the worst offenders. You can also listen for driver whine. A faint, high-pitched buzz at low dim levels is a cheap driver complaining.
The driver whine is one of those things you don't notice until someone points it out, and then you can't unhear it.
It's like the hum from a cheap wall charger. Once you know it's there, it's all you hear in a quiet room. And in a bedroom at night, quiet matters. A light that buzzes at you while you're trying to sleep is failing at its job, even if the light itself is fine.
Spectral chart, dimming floor, flicker. What about the LEDs themselves?
Binning. This is the one that separates a real manufacturer from an assembler. When LEDs come off the production line, they're not all identical. Even from the same wafer, there's variation in color and brightness. Binning is the process of sorting them. A manufacturer who bins their LEDs is one who has a relationship with an emitter supplier, who tests output, who cares that two bulbs from the same box look the same.
The failure mode is two bulbs from the same box that aren't the same color.
Which you've seen. Everyone's seen it. You buy a pack of bulbs, screw one in, it's warm and lovely. Screw the second in, it's slightly pink or slightly green. That's the binning problem. The manufacturer didn't sort or bought from a supplier who didn't sort, and the variation shows up in your living room.
A brand that prints 670 is more likely to bin because they've already told you they measured the emitter.
That's the correlation. The badge implies the process. Not perfectly, but it's a useful heuristic.
Then there's thermal management. You said wavelength shift.
LEDs shift wavelength as junction temperature rises. A poorly heat-sunk 670 light may drift off its claimed peak as it warms up. The wavelength moves, the output changes, and over time the whole thing degrades faster. Lumen depreciation. That's the gradual dimming of an LED over its lifetime. Good thermal design slows both. It's not something you can see on a spec sheet easily, but it's why a light with a chunky metal housing and a decent heatsink costs more than a plastic bulb that's all emitter and no cooling.
The thermal story is one of those invisible quality differences. You can't see it on the shelf. You can't see it in the listing photo. But it's the difference between a light that's still working at full spec in 5 years and one that's drifted off and dimmed out.
The drift is insidious because it's gradual. You don't notice it day to day. But if you compared a new unit to a 2-year-old unit side by side, you'd see the difference. The wavelength has shifted, the output has dropped, and the whole thing is just slightly off from what you paid for.
The last thing, direct narrowband red versus phosphor, converted amber.
Two different ways to make red light. Direct narrowband red LEDs are exactly what they sound like. The semiconductor emits at the target wavelength. They're more efficient, more spectrally pure, and more expensive. Phosphor-converted amber uses a blue LED with a phosphor coating that shifts the output. Cheaper, broader in spectrum, and it ages differently. The phosphor degrades over time, so the color shifts as the product gets older.
For a sleep light, the narrowband is the better choice, but it's also the pricier one.
That's where the honest note comes in. Above a certain point, the returns flatten. A decent amber bulb used consistently beats an optimal one used occasionally. The best spec sheet in the world doesn't help if the light stays in the drawer.
Walk me through the actual shopping heuristic. You're on Amazon. What do you check?
4 things. 1, is there a published spectral power distribution chart and does it show a narrow peak? 2, how low does the dimming actually go and does it step or fade at the bottom? 3, do the phone camera flicker test when it arrives? 4, does the brand name its emitter supplier or does it just say LED?
The documentation tells you which kind of company you're dealing with. A real manufacturer publishes a spectral chart, quotes melanopic EDI, or at least knows what it's when you ask, and names its emitter. A bad one prints 670 with no chart, no binning information, no thermal specs.
The badge without the evidence.
Oh, right. The number with nothing behind it.
I sold halogen bulbs in Birmingham in the mid-90s. Wholesale. Before LEDs were a consumer thing, and we had the same binning problem. Retailers would order warm white and get boxes that range from candlelight to hospital corridor. Same part number, same supplier, completely different color. It drove them mad. The binning wars, we called them. Nobody printed a wavelength on a halogen box. You got a wattage and a vague color word, warm white, soft white, daylight, meaningless. The variation was enormous, and nobody could do anything about it because the bulbs were made the way they were made. When I see 670 on a modern spec sheet, I don't read it as a wavelength. I read it as a price signal. The brand is telling you it knows its audience is informed enough to look for that number, which means it can charge more. The badge isn't just a proxy for manufacturing seriousness. It's a proxy for who the manufacturer thinks you are. The funny thing is, the binning problem I saw with halogens in 94 is now solved by the same brands that print 670. Because binning is expensive, only manufacturers who care about their reputation bother. So the badge correlates with a quality culture, not just a quality process.
That's a different angle. The badge is pricing.
It fits, though. A brand that prints 670 is signaling to a buyer who's done some research. That buyer is willing to pay more, so the badge does double duty. It signals quality, and it signals that the brand knows you're the kind of person who looks for quality.
Which means the badge itself is part of the product. You're paying for the measurement, literally.
That's fine, as long as you know it. The measurement is real, the binning is real, the quality culture is real, you're just paying for it.
I want to pull on that thread a little more, because I think there's a version of this that's less benign. The badge as a way to extract a premium without actually delivering the goods. Someone prints 670 on the box, copies the language from a competitor, and charges 50% more. The number is doing all the work, and the product underneath is the same cheap LED with the same cheap driver.
That's the Dart pattern version, and it absolutely exists. The badge is easy to copy. The process isn't. So you get counterfeit badges. And the only defense is the documentation, the spectral chart, the emitter supplier, the melanopic EDI. If the badge is there but the documentation isn't, you're paying for a number on a box.
That's why I always say the question to ask is, what's behind the number? Not, what's the number? Anyone can print 670. Not everyone can show you the chart that proves it.
That's the whole episode in one question. What's behind the number?
I've got one of those lights now, the narrowband one. Bought it 2 years ago. It dims down to almost nothing, no flicker, no wind, cost more than I wanted to spend, but it's still on the bedside table and it works every night. The cheap one I bought first died in 6 months. The driver went, started flickering, then just stopped, so I bought the expensive one. And the expensive one is still there, that's the whole story.
The cheap one died at the driver. That's exactly the failure pattern we were describing.
The expensive one is still there because the thermal design and the driver were the things the extra money bought, not the wavelength. The wavelength was the same on both boxes.
670 on both. One's in a landfill, and one's on my bedside table.
That's the badge. Same number, different product.
The shopping heuristic distills down to this. Look for a published spectral chart with a narrow peak. Check the dimming floor. Do the phone camera flicker test at the bottom of the range. And check whether the brand names its emitter supplier or just says LED.
The honest note. Above a certain point, the returns flatten. A decent amber bulb used consistently beats an optimal one used occasionally. The best spec sheet in the world doesn't help if the light stays in the drawer.
Which leaves the open question, the correlated signal versus causal ingredient distinction. Where else are you shopping on a badge that's actually a proxy for something else?
That's the one to sit with. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.